Hello, it's Monday, 7th of June. I'm Andrew Pearce, and this is The Daily Show coming from the Daily Mail newsroom. Coming up, we're going to the BAFTAs to get all the latest gossip from the red carpet. Sport, big row about England's performance against Romania just before these European championships. Why racial equality in the workplace can be very good for your business. The baby, Harry and Meghan's baby, Lilibet. Why did they do that, do you think? But first, I'm talking to a senior Tory MP about why we should not be delaying Freedom Day on June the 21st. So more and more Conservative MPs warning of the damage they say further delays to the June 21st Freedom Day could cause after the Health Secretary, Matt Hancock, said he was absolutely open to delaying it. Mr. Hancock refused to rule out keeping face masks and home working beyond June the 21st, the date the government has promised to remove all legal limits on social contact. I'm joined now by Harriet Baldwin. She's the Conservative MP for West Worcestershire and she's a member of the COVID recovery group. Harriet Baldwin, are they preparing us for some bad news, do you think, your ministerial colleagues?
They do seem to be extremely cautious, don't they? And they're looking at the data very, very carefully in terms of some of these new variants and also whether the vaccinations work against the new variants. And I think, you know, I've always felt that we should be very confident in the vaccines. I think it's wonderful that so many people are taking the vaccine. And it does look as though they're doing the job in terms of preventing hospitalizations and death. And I think that we will see cases ticking up. After all, we have relaxed things since the 17th of May, but I don't think we're seeing much of an uptick in terms of hospitalizations. And obviously that's a lagging indicator. And then very sadly, deaths take a while as well. But it's very, very careful watching, I think, by the Department of Health. And I have every confidence that the vaccines are doing the right thing.
And the point, isn't there one of the points as well about the vaccine, Harriet, that the vaccine is giving us a huge advantage in the sense that we perhaps can get back to work normally, can get theatres open again, pubs and restaurants, you know, are only operating half full, which means many of them are operating at a financial loss. Having that vaccination success, can't we be a bit bolder?
I do think that there's a lot to be said for just giving people that responsibility and choice. You know, as Conservatives, we should be about responsibility and choice. And I have heard the Prime Minister start using those kinds of words. So people understand how the virus spreads now. They understand the kinds of things that they can do, reduce the chance of transmission, but also importantly, they've shown up in their droves to have vaccinations. And I think that is, you know, excellent. I think I'm really proud of the UK and the fact that we're leading on vaccinations, we're leading on willingness to have the vaccinations. And I do think that ought to give us an edge in terms of reopening our economy with confidence.
And also there is a suggestion that many of the people who have been hospitalised, and you make the point that they're not as seriously ill as in previous spikes in the infection rate, and the death rate is certainly considerably lower, but many of the people in hospital are people who've not been vaccinated for whatever reason. Maybe they've refused or the vaccination hasn't reached them. Should the whole of our opening up be delayed because of some refuseniks?
It shouldn't, and we should be pushing to vaccinate as quickly as possible. I know it's down to the age of 30 now, but I know that there are many people in their 20s also really keen to be vaccinated. I think we should be trying to move heaven and earth to enable that as quickly as possible. It's dependent on supply and manufacturing, of course it is, but let's get those jabs in the arms of everyone to make sure that everyone who wants them has had a chance for a vaccination. And of course there will be a few people who choose not to, and I'm not in favour of compulsion at all. But we certainly shouldn't shut down the whole economy because of a few refuseniks. Of course we shouldn't. We should all now be making sensible choices and taking responsibility for our own actions. Because importantly, we now have the confidence that the NHS is not going to be overwhelmed again.
And can I ask you about on another issue today? We don't know yet if the Speaker's made his mind up, but it appears the Speaker might not be calling this amendment on, which would enable some of your Conservative colleagues to vote against the cut in foreign aid. If that vote does go ahead, however, Harriet, which side of the fence is the wrong word? Which side of the argument are you on?
Well, look, I think whatever your views are in terms of international aid, I think all of your listeners would agree that when Parliament passes a law, which it has done in terms of point seven, it should be down to Parliament to change that allocation. And it's got to be given to Parliament to decide. And so I think on the basis of the fact that it was A, in the manifesto on which I was re-elected, B, it's in law and it really needs Parliament to have a say, I do hope that the Speaker selects the amendment today. And I do want to stand by the world's poorest, because I actually think the smartest thing we can do to open up global Britain is to vaccinate the world with our excellent vaccines.
But isn't there an argument that the world changed since the publication of the Conservative Manifesto, Harriet? The world changed and it was called COVID-19.
Of course, and that's why the link is to the size of the economy. And so, of course, everyone accepts that as the economy shrinks, we spend less on overseas aids. Of course, we see that. As we recover, I would like it to be British vaccines and Oxford-based inventions that go into the arms of the poorest countries of the world rather than the Chinese ones.
And we are going to be selling that vaccine to the rest of the world at cost price.
We are. And wouldn't it be wonderful for the very poorest countries that don't have access to borrowing in the bond markets at the rates that we currently enjoy, that they also help to vaccinate as quickly as possible? Because that's the best way to stop further variants developing. It's the best way to make the world safer for everyone here at home.
All right, that's Harriet Baldwin. She's the Conservative MP for West Worcestershire and a member of the COVID Recovery Group. Visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe to get access to all our podcasts, our videos, our opinion pieces and lots more. If you want to get in touch, tweet us at MailPlus or me at Tory Boy Pierce. Harry and Meghan, finally their newborn daughter, and guess what they called it? They did. Lilibet, to be known as Lily Diana Mountbatten Windsor, born on Friday in Santa Barbara, California. The choice of name is likely to have raised eyebrows, at the very least, in Buckingham Palace. Lilibet is a very private and special nickname for the Queen, used only by the late Duke of Edinburgh. I'm joined now by the Mail's editor-at-large, Richard Kay. Richard, I'd have laid money it was going to be Elizabeth or Diana. I would never have thought Lilibet.
Definitely thought Diana would feature. I thought Diana first name because William had already got Diana for Princess Charlotte as her middle name. But no, he's gone for Lilibet, but not Elizabeth. I mean, it is extraordinary. We have to assume that they ran it by the Queen and they asked her permission. We have to assume it in the absence of knowing for sure. But it will have done more than raise eyebrows among family members and courtiers. This is using a very intimate and very personal private nickname. And it's not widely known that the Queen, among her very close coterie of friends and family, was known as Lilibet. And frankly, who actually these days calls her Lilibet?
Yeah, I mean, you think occasionally when you see these interviews, people like the Countess of Mountbatten, but she's dead now. She would call her Lilibet, and probably Pamela Hicks, maybe.
People like Mrs. Margaret Rhodes, who was a great friend of the Queen's, she definitely would have called her Lilibet. The one person who did, of course, was Prince Philip, and he's no longer around, but the Prince of Wales certainly doesn't call his mama Lilibet, and nor do any of the children.
Is it an olive branch? Is it a PR stunt?
Well,
it's certainly working well in America because it's leading all the US TV bulletins and radio bulletins.
Of course.
They've named their child after the Queen.
Yes, I mean, cynics are going to wonder about the strategy behind this. I mean, it sort of cements the Sussexes right to the Queen's side for perpetuity. But it saddles this child, an American great-grandchild, don't forget, of the Queen, with the name of the monarch, and it's what's hard to reconcile, Andrew, is it's only a couple of months ago that Harry and Meghan were complaining about the racist attitudes within the royal family, and yet they've chosen the name of the dominant figure in British royal life as the name of their new child.
And he also, Harry, talked about how the genetic grief that had been passed on to him by his father, which in turn he said his father had endured too, in other words, as a result of the way he was brought up by the Queen and Prince Philip.
Yes, so what's going on here? I mean, is he hypercritical of the way royal family members are raised and educated, or is he in fact honouring the great-grandmother, the grandmother that he adores. I mean, there is no doubt that he had a very close relationship with the Queen. Whether it was any closer than any other of her grandchildren is a moot point. But I think she did step in after Diana's death. The royal family show love and affection in very different ways from the rest of us. But she was definitely there for him. And I think he did want to honour her in this way. But to choose the nickname and not her full Christian name seems highly bizarre.
And they're going to call her Lily, spell L-I-L-L-I.
Very Californian, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, this will be the Queen's first American-born member of her family.
Yeah, and the question is just how much is she going to see of this child? Mm. Will there be a christening?
Yeah.
And if there is a christening, will it be in California or will it be in the United Kingdom? I suspect the former. And how often are Harry and Meghan going to be here with their children to visit Granny?
I suppose we should be relieved they didn't call the daughter Oprah.
Now, that would have been something.
That would have been something, wouldn't it? And do you think Oprah's going to be one of the godparents?
Oh, I wouldn't be at all surprised. I mean, she seems to be as firm a fixture in the Sussexes' life as the Sunshine Saxe PR agency.
Yeah. Now, interestingly, that there was no reflection of Meghan's mother, Daria, in the name. Nothing.
No, and that means they're two children, and we're led to believe that Harry and Meghan will have no more. They're just sort of honouring their commitment to the planet.
Yeah,
two children,
course.
And maximum of two. Another dig at their sibling rivalry between William and Harry, of course. But no mention of any Markle name in either Archie's names or in Lilibet's.
Mm. You think the christening will be in? You think the christening will be in the United States?
I think it's inevitable. Mm. I mean. Travelling between our two countries at the moment is difficult anyway.
Yeah.
We know Harry is due here on July the 1st. The fact that the baby
that's
is
for
now
his,
born...
the unveiling of his mother's statue.
Indeed, that's the date of what would have been Princess Diana's 60th birthday.
Mm.
He and William teamed up to get this statue commissioned, and it will be unveiled then. We assume he'll be there. We don't know whether Meghan will be accompanying him at all.
She'll probably stay at home with the baby, I would think.
Well, it would be a good excuse not to come, of course.
I mean,
there are still some issues.
Of course.
Unresolved issues between them and the rest of the royal family.
And if you recall, last time we never really found out who the godparents were, did we?
No.
They didn't tell us.
There was no announcement about the godparents last time. And then, indeed, the whole drama around the baby's birth was ridiculous. I mean, they dressed it up as a riddle inside an enigma. I mean, why would they not say which hospital it was born in?
Mm.
It was the first signs of the Sussexes really trying to break out of their what they see as their royal cage.
And do we think that the palace, that the Queen and her family was told in advance of the public announcement, or was the public announcement the first they knew? There was some suggestion that Buckingham Palace was caught on the hop.
Well, I believe the family were told of the baby's birth on Friday, late on Friday evening. Whether it applied to the officials, the courtiers who represent the royals, I don't really know. The issue surely, though, is what sort of notification was there about the name? Because that is something you have to assume Harry did ask his grandmother's permission.
It is so private, and as you say, so nobody we think now left alive uses that name for her.
I really don't think there is, Andrew. I mean, and on the surface, it does seem remarkably presumptuous if he didn't ask his grandmother's permission.
How could she say no?
But how could she say no? And of course, she wouldn't. She wouldn't deny him.
Yeah, I wonder if that was a conversation they had when he came here for the Duke's funeral.
Quite possibly.
Because she never leaks, we'll never know. But they leak all the time, Richard, so we'll probably find out, won't we?
The rest of them do, yeah.
That is our editor-at-large, Richard Kay, talking about the new royal baby, Lilibet or Lily. Racial discrimination, sadly, still rife in Britain, but companies which try to deal with it actually see increased profits. This is according to a new study. Businesses who provide additional support to ethnic minority employees report up to 58% higher income. That's according to the Henley Business School Research. I'm joined now by Dr. Naima Pasha, who's Director of Equity, Diversity and Inclusion at Henley Business School. Dr. Pasha, how have you managed to extrapolate these figures? On what basis?
What we looked at this research, we split it into three methodologies. So The method we're talking about here is we looked at a quantitative survey to look at how employees felt and business leaders felt about race and race equity. We also did a deeper dive doing interviews with people, and we also did an analysis of data looking at the FTSE 350. And this is what we did when we look at the 58%. What we did here was take a sample of 100 companies from the FTSE 350 and look at what they did in terms of targeted racial equity measures and looked at the correlation around revenue gains. And what we found was those organizations that implemented practical measures around race equity outperformed those organizations that didn't. And that's the figure we discussed.
And what sort of measures are you talking about that these companies that have benefited in terms of increased profits and turnover, what sort of measures did they bring in which presumably encouraged the ethnically diverse staff to produce more or work harder or whatever?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. And if I may, I think what we looked at really is when we looked at organisations that started to do this, it's initially feeling comfortable with starting the process and initially feeling comfortable with thinking this is work in progress and we can't perhaps get worried about getting things wrong, getting terms wrong, you know, should we call it this, should we call it that? Let's just start thinking how we can start making our organizations more diverse, because we know diversity contributes to creativity, which innovation, so on. So diversity is one thing. The next thing is around inclusion. So how does everybody in an organization start feeling more comfortable with what's going on? And then the final step about equity, to ensure that people from all backgrounds could are not held back by things like racism or other forms of discrimination.
I'm interested in your research because in those FTSE 350 companies, I wonder how many ethnic staff were in senior positions, Dr. Pasha, and perhaps the ones where they are in senior positions, are they the companies where you've identified that they have been investing in measures to make it more equitable for ethnic staff?
Yeah, no, that's an interesting. Well, there aren't enough senior staff from Black and ethnic minority backgrounds. So I don't think it's that. I think it's the people that we highlighted, particularly in the case study, was AstraZeneca, WPP. We talked about the CBI as well. And it's organizations actually recognizing this business link. And this is, you know, obviously we're a business school. We're looking at this business link of what race equity does to an organization. And essentially, our finding, for some reason, is that when you start looking after your staff and they feel included and they feel comfortable and they feel valued, they're going to work better, which is what you've just said. So, no, so WPP don't have that kind of, AstraZeneca don't have that kind of, but they're driving towards it and putting things in place. So it's really about the values the organisation is trying to promote rather than...
If you'd looked at this 10 years ago, do you think it would have been entirely different? Would it have been much more disappointing, the outcomes?
Yeah, I think the outcomes in terms of the two outcomes is the outcomes I don't think will be different in terms of knowing that the equity effect is going to be there. When you've got a broad range of talented people in your organisation, it is going to impact your organisation for success. When we look at the levels of people's experiencing race and racism in the organisations, other form of discrimination, yeah, I think we're progressing. I think 10 years ago it would have been different.
Mm. So if people tuning in listening to this, companies who may be listening, what's your advice to them?
The advice comes from the data, actually. So the data suggests that when organisations from all backgrounds, all races, start addressing this and thinking this is good for an organisation, let's start the process, let's start conversations, let's run training, let's first gather the data to see where we are, let's look at what kind of organisation we want to be. Once you start that strategy, things will start to progress and then it will become more comfortable and, you know, part of the furniture of a business, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, I do. Very interesting. That's Dr. Naima Pasha. She's Director of Equity, Diversity and Inclusion at the Henley Business School. Thanks for joining us. Visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with our other podcasts and our video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. Deputy Sports Editor Matt Gatt was here with the latest. Now, I know there was an England football match against Romania. Somebody missed a penalty. We only just about won, and it was all a bit of a mess, wasn't it, Matt?
It was a bit of a mess. It was very strange, actually, because we're a week away now, or we were yesterday, from England's first game against Croatia. That's next Sunday. Mm. So this seemed like a great opportunity for Southgate to kind of play, you know, what may almost resemble his full team. Now, obviously, there are reasons that he couldn't do that, or reasons that he felt he couldn't do that, in as much as the Man City players and the Chelsea players had only just joined up with the squad since playing in the Champions League final. But because he played this sort of weird team yesterday, which there were some players playing in that team yesterday who aren't even going to the Euros.
Pointless.
Well, exactly. So it just felt, it's our third choice goalkeeper. I think three players who aren't even going to the Euros. And basically all the other players, pretty much, maybe apart from Jack Grealish, were players who aren't going to feature in the starting 11. So, look, he will argue, well, you know, I've only just got them. I don't want any injuries, you know.
Well, then why bother have the match?
Why bother having the match? I mean, you know, he will argue, well, Jack Grealish got a bit of a run out, et cetera, et cetera. But it just seemed a real sort of strange one. You've got a week to recover till the first game. So basically, we're going to go into the Euros now with a team who haven't played together at all in the build-up to the tournament. And now, yeah, as I say, Southgate will argue, well, what could I do? They've all been playing in the European final, so I had no choice. But, I mean, it seems to me I'd have said to him, well, let's just go with our best 11. And we've got a week, you know, it's our last chance to play some sort of competitive game.
And we beat Romania 1-0. Are Romania any good?
No, they're not even in the Euros, which is such a big...
Where would they be in the top 20? Would they even be in the top 20?
No, they'd be ranked 45 in the world or something.
And who missed a penalty?
So this was the other slight sort of blip on the day, was the fact that Jordan Henderson, he's coming back from injury. He's trying to prove his fitness.
Okay, who does he play for normally?
He plays for Liverpool. He's a Liverpool captain. He's normally a guaranteed starter in the England team. Because he hasn't kicked a ball since February, he's desperately trying to prove his fitness before the first game. Now, I don't think there's any chance he's going to start on Sunday because he's not fit enough. Dominic Calvert-Lewin, the Everton striker, won a penalty. He was the one who was supposed to take it because they have this pecking order in terms of who takes penalties. But Jordan Henderson, who's played loads of England games, he's probably got 50 odd caps but never scored, took the ball off Dominic Calvert-Lewin and said, no, I'm having this, so that he could score his first England goal, and then promptly missed the penalty. So
was it saved or did you miss the goal?
Saved, but Southgate was not. And now Southgate's a fairly mild mannered manager, you know, he's not one to fly off the handle, he's fairly considered, calm, and so for him to be critical of Jordan Henderson the way he was afterwards was quite unusual. So.
And would the other bloke have scored the penalty, do you think?
Who knows, but yeah, you'd like
how
to think
can,
so.
How can an international player not score a penalty?
Yeah, but you can't say that. Well,
yeah, you can.
Well, but then you'd have to say, well, how come an international goalkeeper never saves a penalty?
All right, but at least it was on target. But was it a well struck penalty?
It was well struck, but it was at a good height for the goalkeeper, shall we say? So he didn't cover himself in glory, Jordan Henderson, sadly. So
why didn't the captain get involved and put a stop to it?
He was the captain.
Oh!
The other captain had gone off.
So he was flexing his muscles?
It was very much pulling rank over a junior player. But but he won't be doing that again. They'll have a set.
And who scored the goal that we did get in?
So Marcus Rashford, who captained England.
Football. School meals man.
School meals man. Captain England for the first time, which was great to see.
Yeah.
Young man captaining England for the first time. Scored the only goal of the game, which was also a penalty. But of course, again, the other thing about the game was the start of the game was overshadowed by a minority of the England fans booing the England players who took the knee.
Why do they take the knee? It's not it's a football match. It's not a political rally.
Well,
why do they do it?
They do it because they obviously feel strongly enough about it that they want to make a statement still.
They do know that we could argue about. I would never take the knee.
Well, I wouldn't pretend to be for or against, but what I do know is that it's their choice to do it, and
it's
should be
an organisation that wants to defund the police.
That's as maybe, but the England players have made it very clear that it's not in support of the political movement, it's in support of the stance
it all
of
gets lost in the wash,
and then it gets
really
lost in the wash.
Just on the chap who scored the goal, what's his name?
Marcus Rashford.
Is he the first time we've had a black skipper of England?
No, we have had black captains before. It's not been that frequent, but we have. Paul Ince as captain England, for example.
Okay.
And there have been others, but it's not been that frequent, sadly.
Okay. Now, how's the cricket? It's boring everybody's senses, apparently. Well, nothing new there, then.
I knew you'd like that. I teed you up for that joke by writing your line for you. Yesterday was a bad day for English cricket, if I'm honest. What happened? There was a day lost to rain during this test match, finished...
That was the most interesting day of the match, then.
Which finished on... And so the game finished on Sunday. New Zealand, who are a very good side...
Yeah.
Punch way above their weight given their population, the amount of cricketers they've got on their island. They declared, setting England a target that they could have chased if they'd gone for it.
Right.
So it was almost like, right, go on then, you go for that. And that, now, obviously, as you chase a toggy, you're more likely to lose wickets. So you, there's a balance between going for the runs, losing wickets, thinking you might win, thinking you might lose. There was a great chance for a really exciting final day's cricket. England opted to just go block, 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 not even attempt to go for the runs, and just block it out and play for a draw. Oh. So it was utterly tedious. Dominic Sibley, the opening batsman, got 60 runs off 220 deliveries. So it was really tedious. So what could have been a great example, you know, you've got fans back in the stadium for the first time.
That's really mean-spirited.
You've got the game on TV. You've got people buying into it. They're, you know,
so this is Joe Root's decision.
It would have been Joe Root and the coach, Chris Silverwood, a combination of the two. And they may have said to the players, look, you go and play how you feel comfortable.
I told you it was boring, Matt.
Well, cricket. No, it, this is what makes it such a talking point. It's normally so exciting that when it's boring, it becomes a news story.
The more interesting thing is that the cricketer has been banned.
Yes, yeah, so, and then after the game last night, so once it had dribbled out to a bored draw, Ollie Robinson was handed this ban, which is, at the moment as it stands, is an indefinite ban while they still look into this.
Yeah.
Why they still need to look into...
The racist abuse from when, what was he, 18 or 19?
Exactly. The racist tweets that he sent when 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Now, why they need to still look into it...
He's make a decision.
Well, he's held his hands up and said sorry.
Culture Secretary Oliver Dowden has come out very strongly in his favour.
And so has the Prime Minister, I understand. Yeah. Backed him up as well.
Well, he's a great cricket fan, of course. Look, I think when you're young, you make mistakes, don't you?
I do. I actually think that the fact that it was 10 years ago, I wouldn't obviously defend what he said and what he did, it was 10 years ago. He has then had to apologise publicly on the television, which was quite humiliating and embarrassing for him and almost brought him to tears. Mm. I would then give him a one-game ban and be done with it.
I think that's fair enough.
But to keep it dragging on and hanging over his head like this is probably a little unfair on the lad.
Trouble is, I can't conceive, even when I was 18 or 19, that I could ever phrase those words and put them in a public domain.
No, I completely agree. I can't remember when I was 18, but I know it was a mighty long time ago, and we are very different people, so who knows? And social media might have been new then.
And he's probably had a drink.
He probably had a drink. Social media might have been new, or he may not have understood it. It was a private, not a private concert, etc. But I'm not defending him. Obviously, what he said was
bad. I'm always saying to my mates' kids, just be careful what you put on Facebook, because in 10, 15 years' time, it's going to come back to haunt you.
Yeah, but sometimes other people can put stuff of you on Facebook. So if you're...
And they have. And apparently somebody put something very of me on Instagram only this weekend.
Right.
Apparently. Not in my most flattering light. I may have had a glass of wine.
Right. Well, I will. I'm going to quickly go onto Instagram.
It might not be Instagram. It might be one of. It might be top. Which is the other one? Might be TikTok. That's for young people. They wouldn't put me on TikTok, would they? They don't have a grandpa section.
Don't worry, I wouldn't know how to find that anyway.
Well, I certainly don't. That's Matt Gatwood, the Deputy Sports Editor, who is always very entertaining and very knowledgeable. Last night, BAFTA awards were held largely in person, although the host, Richard Iowade, complained there was no atmosphere at the socially distant ceremony. Well, isn't that his job to create some? Michelle Cole won Best Actress and Best Miniseries for her BBC One drama, I May Destroy You. And Diversity's Black Lives Matter-inspired performance on ITV1's Britain's Got Talent, which sparked 24,500 Ofcom complaints, won the year's must-see moment. I'm joined now by Eleanor Sharples, TV and radio reporter for The Mail. Eleanor, were you surprised for Michelle?
No, I wasn't actually, Andrew. And that series has been praised so much. It's absolutely fantastic. And no, not surprised, but I'm also just delighted for her because people say, you know, she was snubbed from the Golden Globes in the US earlier this year. So I think it's just fantastic that she has been credited finally for someone who like acts in it, has produced it, written it. I mean, yeah, amazing talent.
And it was interesting. I thought I didn't see Normal People, but it's one of those series that I am going to watch. But Normal People's Paul Mescal won Best Actor for his breakthrough role as Connell, and rather charmingly dedicated his win to his co-star Daisy Edgar-Jones, who conspicuously did not win.
Yes, yeah, he did, which was very nice of him. I think he was, I mean, even in the press conference afterwards that we sat in on, he was honestly shocked that he'd won that award. So, yeah, amazing and absolutely fantastic series. I was pleased, actually, because at one point I was starting to think, I was trying to guess who was going to win each category, and I was way off in every single one. So I was pleased Normal People won something finally, because it really took the country last year.
It really did. Everybody was talking about it. I know people who watch one series and then stayed up till 4 in the morning because they watched one after another.
The rest of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
So it's
definitely. It was one of those as well that kind of all ages actually enjoyed. Like, my mum and dad loved it.
Yeah.
So it was brilliant.
And now The Crown missed out. Good. I'm fed up with The Crown.
Yeah, it did.
Kids winning everything.
It did, yeah. It missed out in quite a few categories, actually. It was up for four main awards. Supporting actress, that didn't go to Helena Bonham Carter.
And yet, I thought she was rather good as Princess Margaret, actually.
Agreed. I really liked her. But that was one of my favourite awards because Reiki Iola, who won for Jimmy McGovern's one-off film, Antony, which was absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
She gave quite an emotional speech, which was... but also very, she just delivered it brilliantly. Everything that she said just was lovely. So, it was nice to see. It was nice to see other people and other dramas and, other TV programmes picking up awards for once.
Absolutely.
Actually.
And just finally, tell me about Diversity. Is it really a must-see moment? Because I haven't seen it, obviously. It did inspire thousands of complaints, but I often wonder how whether they're all organised. But was it a remarkable performance?
It was, any performance that they give is always really impressive and they're fantastic dance troupe. But yeah, it was one of those where I didn't watch On Britain's Got Talent when it aired. I went to watch it on YouTube as soon as I'd seen, oh my God, it's getting so many complaints.
Yeah.
This must be something I need to see. So that's when I went to watch it. And it is fantastic. And as Ashley kind of said last night, they felt it was really important to be able to show that. And yeah, they were, I think, quite flabbergasted by winning it as well. So yeah, that was...
Not a surprise,
Well, it was either... It was that or Nigella Lawson's pronunciation of microwave that was one of the other must-see moments. So, yeah,
How does she pronounce... pronounce microwave?
So, apparently, they said last night that it was a bit of a joke in the family, and she pronounced it microwave.
Pretentious. Very glad she didn't win. Always good to talk to you. That's Eleanor Sharples, our TV and radio reporter for the Daily Mail. That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m. you can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.